This is a Federal News Network podcast.
More money to expand the IRS and raises for TSA officers. Both are on the agenda as Congress returns to Washington this week. They're both part of the so-called infrastructure bill the Biden administration has put forth. For how some of this might play out, we turn to WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller. And let's talk about the IRS first. There's debate beginning already whether if they get all of the money that the Biden administration would like them to get, they would in fact collect all the money it would like them to collect.
That's right. I mean, these proposals are so huge. We're talking more than $4 trillion from the White House that a lot of talk is, of course, how are you going to pay for it? One of the most popular ideas, of course, is going back to the IRS. This is an idea, as you know, that's had bipartisan support for many years. The IRS is not collecting enough money, that they're leaving money on the table, literally. Lawmakers from both parties have pointed to study after study and IRS review after IRS review that show that the agency doesn't collect nearly as much money as it could. Democrats have suggested closing major loopholes that allow many of the wealthy and corporations not to pay any taxes, or at least very little in taxes each year. Estimates range from hundreds of billions of dollars up to recently $1 trillion. The question is, does the IRS have enough resources to do something like this? The agency's budget has been cut for much of the past decade or has just held steady. IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig told Congress last month that with the modernization of computer systems and more enforcement personnel, the IRS could do a lot more to bring in more money, but we'll have to see where this goes.
All right. And then with respect to the TSA officers, that's also a debate now because the proposal in the bill would put them into the general schedule system as other federal employees and give them raises. And I guess the argument going there is, why would you put them in something that is already old-fashioned and suspect?
Right. And this is getting a lot of attention, too, just because of the situation that we're in now, right? People are starting to actually think about traveling again. The TSA has put out figures that show that there's been more air travel than there's been really in the past year. A House Homeland Security Subcommittee held a hearing last week on this. And there is general agreement among lawmakers that TSA workers are underpaid. Their salaries can start at less than $30,000 a year at some of the airports across the country, depending, again, on what urban area it's in. But lawmakers disagree on how to best fix this situation. Democrats are again backing this bill that would allow transportation security officers, as you note, to earn a salary under the general schedule and also put them under the Title V personnel system, which would, among other things, give them collective bargaining rights. But there's still no consensus with Republicans on this, and it's also still unclear what might happen with this legislation in the Senate. It's generally been getting favorable response over the past few years from Democrats, but Republicans have a lot of reservations about actually putting TSO workers into the general schedule.
Has anyone brought up the idea of simply paying them more under the non-schedule that they're in now?
Right, exactly. And that's certainly an option that a lot of people that say, why complicate all of this? We all generally agree that they are underpaid. Why don't we just raise the amount of money that they're getting paid and put aside, at least for now, some of these more complicated issues about actually how to get them into the general schedule? Of course, it's hard to believe, but now it's been close to 20 years since the TSA has been in operation, obviously going into effect after 9/11.
And just one final point, getting back to the IRS, there's no lawmaker questioning the numbers that the IRS puts forward as to how much it could collect, because I've read a range of studies, and yes, they do range to a trillion, but they also range to, hey, not that much.
Right. There are some skeptics on Capitol Hill that say, you know what, we've talked about this a lot before. You know, it's kind of like that idea of Pentagon spending, where people have always said, oh, well, there's way too much fat and waste in the Pentagon spending. If we just crack down on, you know, the multi-million dollar tool that's the latest one that gets all the attention from the inspector general or something like that, that we could save so much money and then we wouldn't have to raise taxes or do these other fundraising things. So there is a lot of questions about these numbers get thrown around a lot. And as you point out, I mean, some people have said, oh, we could get hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And this estimate of $1 trillion actually did come from the IRS itself. The commissioner said that that could be the gap of the money that they may be leaving on the table, but it's still very unclear about exactly how they could actually get that kind of money into the system.
And that's a 10-year estimate, too, not 1 year.
Right. Very good point. I mean, this is over a long period of time. So it's not like you're just going to all of a sudden say, hey, we just cracked down on this. We've got $300 billion that we can put toward infrastructure.
We're speaking with WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller. And let's move on to a question about members of Congress themselves. Are they vaccinated? What have you seen up there?
Well, it's really interesting. You would think that all members of Congress would be vaccinated by now since they've had access to vaccination for several months. Early on in the pandemic, in connection with not only vaccinations, but testing, a lot of lawmakers were a little bit wary of getting ahead of the public, that the perception would be that they were getting something that the public couldn't. But really, a lot of people said it was the responsible thing to do for lawmakers to get vaccinated. So the vast majority of them have been vaccinated, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recently indicated that there's still about a quarter of the lawmakers on the Hill who are not fully vaccinated, which is really pretty remarkable when they've had access for several months. Now, many of them are Republicans who have declined to get vaccinated for various reasons. Pelosi noted there is really nothing that can be done to actually require lawmakers to get vaccinated. So that's why during the recent joint address to Congress from President Biden, you still saw lawmakers wearing masks, and that is probably going to continue since, with just a few exceptions, no one really knows exactly which lawmakers specifically have not been vaccinated. Some of them have acknowledged they haven't been vaccinated. The number two Republican House Minority Whip, Steve Scalise, relatively recently indicated that he is going to get vaccinated, but had not. But because of this, some doctors and health advocates have said if they were to all get vaccinated, they could actually be a showing and an example to the rest of the public when there is a big gathering like this joint address to Congress, that if they didn't wear masks, they said that that would actually set a good example for the country that the vaccinations are working.
Yeah, here's what a herd looks like. That is
right.
Got the immunity.
Right.
Wonderful. And just a final question. The attack of January 6th, the issue and the event that they love to keep admiring, there's hearings on that coming up. Is there any resolution to that whole question in the offing?
There really isn't. The House Administration Committee is hearing this week from inspectors general who are looking into various issues, the Capitol Police Inspector General testifying today, and the Inspector General of the Architect of the Capitol is to testify on Wednesday. Capitol Police leadership has already come under scrutiny in an earlier Inspector General's report for not doing enough to disseminate information related to intelligence about the January 6th attack. And of course, we've been keeping an eye on all the arrests. There have been more than 400 arrests now. Justice Department saying this is one of the largest investigations ever undertaken. But what is really interesting is the fact that right after January 6th, as you know, there was a lot of talk about a 9/11 type of commission that would review exactly what went wrong, try to make recommendations to say this is what has to be done so this doesn't happen again. But that has just absolutely gotten bogged down. And of course, the culprit is politics. Democrats say that it should focus solely on the insurrection, what went into it, where was the ball drop, and what kind of recommendations can be made to protect the Capitol in the wake of that. Republicans are worried about the scope, and they think that it might just be a blame game for former President Trump. They actually also want to look at some of the protests from last summer with the Black Lives Matter protests. But even some Republicans have questioned that. Liz Cheney, the number three Republican, at least for the moment, until she gets pushed out this week, has said that it should actually be just on January 6th. But the vast majority of Republicans would like it to be much broader. So as usual with these political situations, it's kind of at a stalemate right now.
No wonder they call it a merry-go-round. Mitchell Miller is Capitol Hill correspondent for WTOP. Thanks so much.
You bet.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on your schedule. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Rick Wade, Senior Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Outreach at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Previously, Rick was a Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. He worked closely with the Obama administration, and he also worked with Commerce's Economic Development Administration to foster regional economic development in distressed areas, and with the Minority Business Development Agency to create jobs through the growth of minority-owned businesses. He received a BS from the University of South Carolina and an MPA from Harvard University. Rick, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
And thank you so much for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Rick, in today's environment, leaders have had to adapt and find new ways to lead with transparency and empathy. But can you tell us a bit about how you've adapted your leadership style?
You know, this past year has clearly presented some unique challenges that certainly me, or I as a leader, have had to adapt. You think about a pandemic, for example, that has placed us in probably one of the most challenging circumstances is to sort of lead in a virtual world now. I've not been in my office for nearly a year. And the idea that we don't have the human interaction, which I think is very important when you think about the empathy that is a very important value of leadership. So trying to lead from a virtual environment, Shane, and be empathetic and be sensitive to the needs of others has presented a terribly difficult challenge. One of the other defining moments, I think, in our time that has dictated a change in leadership, if you will, was the murder of George Floyd. I think it created a whole different consciousness in America and certainly within me about the importance of being empathetic in the way I lead, to be inclusive, to lead in a way in which you're very sensitive to the impact of your decisions on others across our community. So it certainly has been a challenging year to adapt, but I'm happy to say that I'm still here and we're moving forward.
Perfect. Throughout your career, what have been some pivotal moments or lessons learned that have shaped the leader that you are today?
You know, there have been so many moments, Shane. I grew up in rural South Carolina. Quite honestly, at a time when I saw what legal segregation was. I mean, I wasn't able to go to an integrated school until middle school, being bused across town. And I remember, as strangely as it may sound, in 1979, I wanted to run for vice president of my student body at Lancaster High School, a rural school. And I had to run on the ballot as vice president Black, literally. And there was another candidate who ran as vice president White. And the irony of that story is that the following year, I ran for president and I won overwhelmingly. That was a lesson for me in leadership. And the lesson there was, you know, perseverance, have the tenacity, have a vision, and overcoming barriers. And I didn't let the idea that the construct that I had to run as vice president deter me from reaching my bigger dream, which was to represent students. So I know that's that perhaps may be a small example of leadership, but it really did define how I view myself, the vision that I have, my willingness to fight for change. And that was the beginning. I think that set the foundation of how I lead. And there've been so many other moments. One of the most defining moments for me personally was the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A very close friend of mine, Senator Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who lost his life. And it conjured up, again, these issues of how deep the divide in terms of race in America is. But it also inspired me to lead even more and to lead harder and to lead with diligence and vigilance to help close that divide. So there have been so many defining moments in my career. I will tell you, even after the murder of George Floyd and my role at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to galvanize the business community inspired by that tragedy. And now we have a whole broad, historic, sweeping, what we call Equality of Opportunity Initiative that I'm leading, that I was inspired to develop. And we're bringing together corporations from across America to address what we call equality of opportunity. So my point there, I think with all of these moments, they've all been pivotal moments at different parts of my life, my career, my journey. And I've seized those moments to make the best of them, of what I could.
That's fantastic. It's a great, great answer. Many stories. Thank you very much for sharing that. Who is the most impactful leader in your life? And what quality did you admire about them?
You know, I can't say that I had just one, but I would tell you the one person whose historical leadership has inspired me the most, and that is the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there's so many attributes there that are consistent with my values, but the one part of his leadership was vision. And I mean, the idea that you can have a dream, which we often define and think of his big I Have a Dream speech. But I think that's a really important attribute of leadership, Shane, that you can sort of see beyond the challenges of today and see a better future for people and for yourself. So the idea that leaders have vision despite the challenges is seeing a forest despite the trees. It's seeing an opportunity despite the barriers. And that attribute, I think, is one that I embody. I mean, I'm very optimistic despite the challenges, despite the circumstances. So the whole notion of vision was a very important attribute that I learned and that I've tried to emulate from the leadership of Dr. King.
Wow, fantastic. And as someone who's got an extensive background in federal service and out of federal service, what advice would you give to feds looking to develop leadership skills? And you can talk about mid-career, senior career, early career. What comes to mind there?
Yeah, listen, I mean, you're aware that I had the fortunate opportunity. We didn't have a Secretary of Commerce when President Obama, of course, I served as one of his senior advisors, was inaugurated. And the president asked me to go to the Department of Commerce to hold the fort down. And that was one of the most exciting experiences in my entire career, not just for the title and the wonderful experiences, but I understood the value of federal employees. And folks forget sometimes, Shane, that we political appointees, we come and go. But the folks who are grinding every day, who are at their desk no matter rain, sleet, or snow, who bring innovations but yet don't get the credit for it because the political appointees get all the credit. I think I learned something about the humility of being a leader. And I built so many friends who were federal employees, not just at the manager level, but the frontline workers, the administrative assistants. And I was very deliberate. I mean, one of the things that I was most proud of, strangely enough, I was that guy, even though I was senior advisor to the Secretary of Commerce. And my office was on the floor at the top floor. We call it the blue carpet, Shane. But I made a deliberate point to go eat in the cafeteria every day, as many days as I could, just to sit down and talk with employees. And I grew from that. And there were so many times where I took their ideas back to the blue carpet and said, and I told the Secretary Locke, you got to go down and sit down and talk with regular, common, everyday folks. They're in the cafeteria, not in the dining room on the blue carpet. And so he started doing that. So the point is, I think for me, the advice that I would give is to continue to do the hard work. I do think that we should do a better job in government in providing the kind of admiration for those workers as we do the high level appointees. And that may be something that that I'm looking to work on myself to help continue to advocate for our federal employees. Those are the hard workers. That's where the work gets done. And so I think that's a lesson for me. If there was some advice and counsel I could give, is to continue to do your work. But we have to do our work as leaders of these agencies to create ladders of success and reward and admiration for the hard work that they do.
Rick, thank you very much. You've inspired me. These are tremendous insights and stories. I love every single one of them. You've got a fascinating journey in leadership yourself. And thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Thank you for listening to today's Lessons in Leadership podcast. And until we see you next time, take good care.